Hello, 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 beautiful people, and welcome back to another episode of the USL Show. Hope you are so excited. We have a lot to cover in this one. Lots of recaps, a lot of youth movement stuff that's officially here. Atlanta is back, and some people are confused. But hey, John, how are you doing, man?
Yeah, I'm doing really well. It kind of stinks that it's just two of us for what was an insane weekend. This felt like maybe the week where we started to actually learn things about teams, I want to say. So yeah, excited to get into it all.
Speaking of only two of us being here, everybody go send some love to Ryan and Alan. Like, send big love to them. I'm not going to share their news out in, you know, here, obviously. But, you know, go find them on social. Send them lots and lots of love. I want to do something real fast, and this is different than just our normal patrons, which includes, you know, John Hunter, Frank Anthony, Aaron J, Christopher Cohn, Harry Austin, John Fuller, Michael Fuchs, Joshua Deuter, Noah Telford, and Alberto Aguilar. Thank you guys so much for supporting us. And in that, part of your support is going to be getting us to our first ever on location show. We can't really announce where we're going yet because a part of that is figuring out how to kind of get there. So we say this at the end of a few shows, but we're going to put it up here bright and bold. We are for sale. We are looking for a sponsor. I mean, I kind of say that jokingly, but like, we're looking for a sponsor. If someone has a company that wants to get something read on, you know, I guess a somewhat national audience, like, it's, you know, it's there. If you want to support us, we are looking to travel. We're trying to get 5 people traveling, which is a lot. And even if it's only just a little bit coming out of our pocket, as long as we can get most of this covered, we will be good to go. We'll share more about that once we kind of have that. If you are looking for us, our work email is theuslshow@gmail.com. It's in the description. If you're listening to podcasts, it will be there as well. Please check that out. We would love to actually get this show rolling and on location, which we've been waiting to do for a long, long time now. So, all that said,
we can be bought.
We can be bought. We're not afraid. Order for tonight's show. I want to just go ahead and hop right into it. Atlanta, well, Roswell, Georgia was announced as a Super League contender, or was awarded a Super League team. But that's not the part that caught people's eye. It was the fancy gold letter beside it, or I guess like symbol, it's a star. The championship as well. The USL going back for the first time since Atlanta United 2, which people were very excited on the Super League front, but are left very confused on the championship front. What are your kind of thoughts about this, John?
Yeah, I mean, I want to start out with the Super League team, because no matter how you come at that team, that's going to be a huge deal for the league. Atlanta is a market that has shown it can support the men's game at an extent that's basically unmatched in America right now. So if you can transport that support to the Super League, that can be a real boon for what this organization is trying to do. That can be the anchor tenant for this soccer-specific stadium that they're trying to set up in Roswell. So everything about that, love it 100%. I think from the championship side of things, it can be thornier. There is an argument that, okay, you're putting this team out in a semi-affluent suburb. If they do come with this stadium project that really makes it a can't-miss fan experience, maybe you're able to get enough butts in the seats to make it all work. Given the fact that this is a growing sport, you can siphon off some of the suburban contingent that's going for Atlanta United. But I do have my concerns that you're entering one of the markets that's really the spine of Major League Soccer right now. Given how things went at the end with Atlanta United 2, which is so apples and oranges, it hardly even begs comparison. I do have some qualms, but overall, I'm just so happy about the women's side that I want that to be the focus, probably.
Yeah, so I was a little bit a little bit confused on a bit of location. Now, Roswell, I know, is very close to where my wife grew up. So, like, I know that area well, but I kind of got my size mixed up because they're not too far from where the Silverbacks played, like, at all. I think it's like a 20-minute drive at most. So I was thinking that maybe they would just kind of go to Silverbacks Park and do that and be like a spiritual successor, which it does. That's obviously not the plan. You mentioned a soccer specific stadium. I want to say this though, people, and we get this moment in the chat. Edwin kind of talks about the men's side felt miserable. I understand people saw the attendance. I do. But if you ever made your way down to Atlanta United to watch the games at Kennesaw, genuinely, those are some of the most passionate fans I had met. There were real two United fans. And it wasn't just a little, like, they had drums, they did the whole thing. Like, they were passionate about that group. There are people that want to support more than just Atlanta United. And as big as Atlanta is, I think some people don't fully realize how big Atlanta is. Atlanta's a massive, 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 like, city. I think the DeKalb County is bigger than, like, that county is, like, bigger than the metro, or Atlanta's bigger than where Birmingham is, like, the county that metro.
The metro is one of the five or six biggest in the country. Like, if you're going to have two cities in any market, Atlanta is on the list, the very short list of cities where you should try it.
Right. And the where this is as well is that it might be easier to get to than Mercedes-Benz. Mercedes-Benz for Atlanta United, it's a beautiful facility. I get it. I've been there several times. It's wonderful. It's not the easiest to get to. And so I wonder if that this is going to be just more accessible for people. This is just going to be a more accessible place. And if you say, well, only, you know, 3,000 people will show up, it's like, well, that still puts them as one of the better attended teams in the league.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, if you look at the numbers of some of the teams that have joined the league, like, it's not necessarily that far from the standard right now. I think from the league-wide perspective, what are you gaining from getting the Atlanta television market at the same time? Like, that's, we're in a place where that matters going forward for the USL from a corporate television, from sponsorship. So there's a lot at play here. Like, I think my first reaction is I have questions, but I think the strategy behind letting them do what they're doing is sound.
I think a big part of this is obviously Super League, right? And this is a genuine question. Are they allowing people or, like, cities to be only Super League? Because other than Dallas, Fort Worth, they're the only one that don't have an active team, but they will also have franchise rights. So are they only attacking cities that have current, like, franchise rights given out? Because it feels like they're trying
What's
to create
the deal with Fort Lauderdale.
I mean, technically, I think that's St. No, wait.
No, there's a separate Tampa Bay team, but they're not even owned by the same group that owns the Rowdies. So,
right.
Yeah. But yeah, Fort Lauderdale is distinct, I think.
Okay. I mean, yeah. DC is only super. Technically, that's right. Well, you could say that's Loudoun.
Loudoun adjacent.
I think that might be loose. It's weird, but I'm excited on Super League part because it's pretty well documented that Atlanta has been craving an NWSL team, and kind of the Southeast, that part of the Southeast has been anyway. And Arthur Brank kind of, drug his feet on it. And then now it's a lot more expensive to get in an NWSL. A lot more expensive. It's a lot cheaper to get into the Super League right now for it to be the same level. It feels like this is on the women's front, like trying to win a market that should have had one a long time ago?
It was hard for me not to look at both legs of this from a very soccer wars perspective right away, just because Arthur Blank has had the talk about, okay, we're going to bring an NWSL team here at some point, just because the men's side, like the obvious conflict there, the fact that the Silverbacks once upon a time were in the market. I think it's important to look beyond that and understand, like, even if there is an NWSL team playing at Mercedes-Benz, I think that this team, if they're on the ground first in Roswell, doing what they do with a high level for the fan experience, that has a really strong argument for coexistence, given the Division I parity, given everything else in that vein. So, but again, I know I keep drilling home, but really bullish on the Super League side of this.
Me too, especially if they can get the wheels really going on this. And granted, this would be way too fast, I think, but let's assume that they can really get it going. Atlanta's hosting part of the She Believes Cup, like, soon. If they can put some feet on ground and get, like, Super League to Atlanta around there, like, even if it's just outside the stadium, set up somewhere, it's a little something to get the ball rolling on what's specifically a women's soccer group. That is a women's soccer crowd to go watch a women's soccer match, international match in Atlanta. Say, hey, professional women's soccer is coming to Birmingham. If they can somehow pull that off, boots on ground, I think that's a big win for the league.
No, 100% agreed. Like, there's going to be plenty of runway for this team to have these opportunities, because Atlanta is that major market that is going to have major opportunities to kind of host the USWNT, really sell the game to fans of women's soccer.
So you kind of mentioned soccer wars, and I didn't really include this on the order for tonight's show, but I kind of want to talk about it. The time where the USL was the bad guy, the big bad wolf, if you will, in the USL. The Red Wolves have announced postponements that are leaving Omaha like a month without playing a game because of changes and upgrades to the pitch and upgrades to the stadium, which I think there's a lot of interesting fronts on this one. If you're Omaha, you're obviously rightfully upset that you're not playing for a whole month. You're trying to find friendlies, if you can find them anywhere, to try to stay match fit. If you're Chattanooga, you're saying it's not our fault. Like, we're trying to make the stadium better. We're trying to build our infrastructure. You know, don't crucify us because we're investing. But this still just ends up with Chattanooga once again looking really bad.
If you're Chattanooga, and what they cited in the press release was, okay, there has been a lot of inclement weather. We couldn't get the grass properly installed in the way that we wanted. Like, yeah, you probably needed to have contingencies in place and understand that this needs to be done a little bit further behind. No one else in the league is really ever having the same problem, and it rains in every market outside of Phoenix, probably. The thing for me is that Chattanooga FC started playing home games a couple weeks ago. They're going to have a month of doing that in MLS Next Pro, showcasing the fact that we're the same level as the Red Wolves now. Why not come watch the soccer that's being played? From a competitive standpoint, like, stinks for Omaha, stinks for the Charlotte Independents. The Red Wolves are going to have pretty mean fixture congestion later on in the year, right? Like, this is a team that did add a lot of depth over the winter, but with the League One Cup, or the Jägermeister Cup, rather, they're going to have just a lot to do late in the season, which, I mean, that's not going to play well for a team that was looking to have a comeback in 2024.
I think the biggest thing that you mentioned there is the fact that their direct soccer wars counterpart, the thing that they kind of tried to kill, is alive. And you know what? Like, they, in their first MLS Next Pro match, they pulled almost 5,000 people. Like, I think there was a world where Red Wolves ownership was kind of hoping that the move to MLS Next Pro would be the death blow, and they're still going just as strong. And now you're giving them a full month of playing at the same time for them to once again be the only show in town for a full month when that could have been avoided. And, you know, there's a little bit of me that says, you know, soccer karma, like the soccer gods kind of find a way. But also, there's going to be a lot of crapping on ownership today. I'm just going to let that be known. But if you're going to, like, start a soccer war, you better be ready to fight it. It's not as simple as USL big and shiny, your MPSL team bad. You know, we're better than you. Because all they've done is shoot themselves in the foot. I can't think of the last time Red Wolves have done something, and I'm like, good for Red Wolves? Like, they're doing something really good? I mean, they're building around their facility. When I went up there, they're really building around that area, and it's really nice. It's really cool that they're building apartments and stuff like that. Like, they're trying to build up that area, but other than that, it's just constant just stepping on rakes.
No, it feels like everything since 2022 has really gone wrong, like a real Murphy's Law situation where even when they're trying to make the right decisions, things are just getting in their way. And I mean, this is another example, right? Like, say it is just that rain has been the problem on the pitch. That's unreal. And it's yet again, just terrible luck for the Red Wolves.
Yeah, I want to, you know, unless you have anything else on this, I want to move on to the new initiative that the USL is doing. So the new initiative, and by the way, Red Wolves, yeah, they won the Open Cup. First time they've ever done that. I mean, good for Red Wolves for winning in the Open Cup.
By the way, what was an insane game where they went down a man, almost blew the lead. It took added time, like just crazy stuff for the Red Wolves.
I mean, they kind of keep the old, like, League One thing of if a team gets a red card, they're still going to win because League One. I mean, what year was that? Was that 2022 when, like, teams who went down a man just kept winning?
Yeah.
Stupid. The USL has said that they are starting a new initiative where they are allowing the addition of two players to the home club's match day roster. And that is the headline. I kind of wish that they would have talked about that more than just saying youth movement in the headline. But basically, if it is a youth player, if they are on a standard player agreement, the club is allowed to allow up to two players that are 17 or younger, or a player who has signed an academy agreement, the home club is allowed two of those players regardless of the player's age at the time of signing the player agreement. So you'll have a follow-up story on this in the morning. Thank you, Nicholas Murray. Hashtag subscribe to the Rondo. Like, please actually do that. It's really good stuff. There's been a lot of discourse on this. I love it. I know that some people were like, this is just another way for them to skirt some, like, salary rules or whatever. Like, you still have to pay appearance fees and anything like that if they play. So, like, there's that. But also, some people, and kind of rightly brought up, Brandon McCarthy brought it up himself, this feels like it kind of favors the home team a little bit. And yes, like, it does, but and I think this is also my own opinion, child labor laws are wild and they're not consistent from state to state. And so if a player is on the bench, they may not be able to travel to another state and be on the bench. I have a feeling that this is the way to kind of just broadly say the home team can do it because you know your own state's child labor laws, you know? And yes, as we always say, please play the youth.
On the child labor laws thing, I don't know if you were seeing the Tom Bogert tweets about New York Red Bulls had that 15-year-old kid who couldn't, he couldn't even be on the bench past like 6 o'clock or 9 o'clock at night because it violated New Jersey child labor laws. Like, if you want to know why maybe it's a little bit difficult to have the academy kids travel, case in point right there. But I mean, overall, on the home away thing, like, sure, if you have two teenagers on the bench, in theory, it helps you out. Those aren't players who are going to be used as tactical subs to change a game outside of the most insane wonder kid you've ever seen in your life. Like, I understand the sentiment of having warm bodies on the bench. Functionally, it doesn't matter competitively. Where it does matter is when you are a home team who's up a couple goals late, you can throw on these kids for 20 minutes and say, go get some run out, get some professional experience, show yourself off, because that's the whole point of the youth movement, right? We want these kids in the shop window showing off that they can compete against grown men so they can be sold on and have better opportunities for themselves and benefit their club in the process. This is yet another initiative that really benefits that aim.
Real quick, Pope, yes, we will talk about, I kind of want to get into that at some point. I think that's an interesting discussion. We'll get to that, I think, in a little bit. His question of, are more teams just playing a 3-4-3? We'll talk about that. Joshua Winder, good example. The biggest thing to me, and I need to check in the weeds of the rules, so I might just be talking out of it, if you know what I mean. But I don't think that players who are not on the match day roster can even go on the field before the game and like warm up with the players. So, or you know what I mean? So like that's my understanding. And there's a lot that comes with being a 15-year-old and getting touches during warmups, being beside the 32-year-old who's been doing this for their entire life and seeing how do they do rondos? How do they do one-touch passes? How do they do this when they're preparing for a game and understanding the rhythm and the flow of a game? Just being a part of that is a lot. That is so much of learning how to be a professional is, I mean, I watched it and I'm not going to air out the kid it was or what team he was on, but there was a kid that I watched Legion play 2 years ago now, and he was a 16-year-old kid who had traveled down for a game, and during the warmups, he was running 110%, like just putting in so much effort into the warmups. And he came on at the end of the game, and when he came on, he was already gassed. Like, learning how to pace yourself during a warm-up, that's stuff that you have to learn how to do. It sounds so stupid because you've done it since you were 12, but the first time you play as a professional, that adrenaline's crazy. Just learning how to pace yourself is just so important on being a professional.
No, 100%. It's having that extra time that you're sanctioned to have now around professional athletes in the context of professional coaching, that when it adds up over the context of 16 home games, 17 home games, really makes a difference for a young player.
Yeah. Do we want to go ahead and get into some of the matches that were?
Yes, please.
All right, let's first start off with the USL Tactics Show, as always. This one came out today with our favorite, Charleston Battery.
Hello, and welcome into the USL Tactics Show, where today I want to talk about Charleston's throttling 4-0 win over New Mexico United and the way that their press completely denied New Mexico joy in the middle of the pitch. As you can see on the heat map there, Charleston was unbelievably effective at denying the central spaces, and you can see that breakdown here. The Battery typically run a 4-2-3-1, and it was no different on Saturday night. Notice the way that the three attacking midfielders and one of their central midfielders, deeper from the pivot, step up to deny New Mexico any access to the midfield. New Mexico is a team that tends to use Marco Micheletto and Zico Bailey. It's the real nexus of their offense. Those two central midfielders drop deep to get touches and create joy. But look how Charleston pressed. They had their wingers take very looping, arcing runs that denied the midfield and drove play to the sidelines. Again, refer to the heat map. This team had no joy in the central areas. Moreover, Charleston was able to turn press-based joy into offensive chances. Because New Mexico was turning over the ball in dangerous areas, Battery then got the ball in more attacking-minded areas. You saw it on the Nick Markanik goal there. You're seeing it again here, where the Battery are able to force a turnover by taking those looping, arcing runs that deny the midfield areas. This is a virtuous cycle that we saw through much of last season, of course. This team is built upon the press, and that's really Ben Pearman's specialty in instilling it. Look at the way they counter-pressed as well. Here, Charleston loses the ball. They're able to get a central midfielder, Aaron Malloy, and their left back, Nathan Dos Santos, to win the ball back, again, in a dangerous position, and then work into Arturo Rodriguez for what ought to be the goal of the week, just nasty stuff, but again, built on the defense. This team is so good going both ways, and it's because of those principles that Ben Pearman is able to instill.
I want to hop in with just this question, and it's not Charleston directly. I'm not saying the result would have changed, but did we ever find out why Tim Bacchus didn't play?
I was asking someone about this a couple around Monday. I didn't really find out an answer. I'm just unclear with the travel of it all. I know they've got Phoenix coming up this week. Probably just had a knock in training is what I'm assuming. But yeah, and someone who knows New Mexico can figure that one out.
Yeah, I mean, that one kind of blew my mind because, I mean, Tim Bacchus was on a heater, like an absolute heater. And I'm not saying that changing your goalkeeper automatically means that you give up four goals. I mean, but with the run that he was on, you feel like a few of those probably get saved. And just organizing the defense. So, you know, that's just something to kind of talk about. But this, by the way, that one was for you, Ben Clemens, and Del Schaefer. We love y'all. One thing I want to really touch on with Charleston is, okay, I don't want to get caught up in the moment. This is week three. I get it. They, as a fan of a team in the East, they scare me more than they did last year.
I think they have more weapons in the arsenal this year. Like, not to say that this team wasn't really good and had a very varied attack last season, but when you think about the depth in the attacking line, the fact that you can just bring someone as explosive as Juan David Torres off the bench, the fact that there's that active competition between Nathan Dos Santos and Josh Drack at left back, so much energy, so much skill in the central midfield, the striker spot with Conway, with MD Myers, they feel deeper everywhere on the pitch, and it's giving Ben Pearman more weapons. There's not a coach in the USL who's better equipped to make good out of that skill, the skill that he has on this squad. I know that I think Louisville has taken up a meaningful step forward. We're going to get to some teams that are contenders, but Charleston, man, they are just amazing.
The one thing that I think I said when we did our championship preview show was that, to me, the key piece in this entire Charleston team was getting Mark Segbers a full offseason.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, he's a big deal, and, you know, it gets dropped into the chat. Aaron Malloy is ridiculous. We've been saying it since he was in Memphis, obviously, but he did everything for Memphis last year. And Ben Pearman getting him back is just disgusting.
You talk about Segbers. When they traded for him at the end of last season or signed him from Miami, they had to play him as an inverted left back. So, like, he's a right-footed guy, and he can play the left back position. Having him on the stronger side has been immense so far and fits in with the way that Pearman wants this team to play. Really big deal.
Yeah. In general, for New Mexico, I'm not too worried about New Mexico. That it just kind of – that felt like a game that kind of was what it was. I don't really feel too – worried in the sense, because they've already shown us two good results. You know what I mean? Like, if
is the Pittsburgh win a good result at this point? That's how I'm reassessing at this point, just given what we've seen from the Riverhounds.
100%. But going into Rhode Island,
that's fair.
That's
a very good point. Yeah,
I'm willing to take. I mean, 3 points are 3 points, right? Mm-hmm. In Pittsburgh, they were what they were, but also going into Rhode Island was what it was. I'm willing to overlook this. Now, if the next game we get just leaky defense, just over and over and over again, silly, sloppy fouls again, I might start to put the finger over the panic button. But yes, just week three, this doesn't feel like anything for me to panic about yet for them.
Phoenix is going to be a good test, just given the way that Rising can pick you apart with so much attacking talent, Panos, and in between the lines. So I think if they can not shut down Phoenix, but stem the tide offensively, that's probably the barometer I'm looking for New Mexico.
I want to have a quick conversation about Vegas and El Paso. Vegas gets their 1-0 lead, or gets their 1-0 win. And maybe I'm wrong here, but first win under Bautista. And, you know, it's a scrappy 1-0 win. And want to be happy for them. Ryko Rosarena looked like the happiest human of all time. That was just fun to watch. The El Paso side can't be ignored. 5 matches in 12 days with a friendly, which is so cool that they were playing against their sister city right across the border, but they could not have put it at a worse time in the schedule at all. And a lot of this is compounding with the fact that they didn't get good results. If they had gone and gotten 2 wins, you know, played their friendly and then lose to, you know, Las Vegas, I feel like we could say had a little bit of fixture congestion, but whatever. This early in the season for you to play 5 matches in 12 days is just malpractice. It's like you don't care about the player's health.
The thing with the friendly, both of the clubs sharing the ownership, the fact that El Paso is still waiting on a couple of players to come over on loan that haven't quite got their papers figured out yet. And El Paso really has been running what I would call like a 15-man rotation. Like, they're not using the depth in that squad to much of a degree at all. Someone like a Lucas Stoffer, who's going end to end at the wingback spot, like, I feel bad for that guy's lungs right now. And especially given the fact that El Paso has some tactical holes right now where they're getting played over constantly into the channels, the fact that they can't consistently create down the middle, it's all kind of coalescing into this snowball effect that they're really suffering for it. And credit to Las Vegas for getting that win, by the way. Systematically, I think Dennis Sanchez is making the right changes that they need to make. I think that they really put a priority on the defensive solidity on the wings. When you're putting Joe Zhao and Gausu Samake there, those are guys who have played fullback in their careers. Like, they still have the speed to get upfield, do damage alongside Corey Bennett, but there's a real two-way effect to when you have them versus like a Solomon Asante, who, while he's still a great player, he's not necessarily that defender. And I think it was totally the right call to kind of stem what the Locomotive do. But El Paso came in weak for the reasons we've delineated, and Las Vegas took advantage.
This is kind of where I want to talk about the kind of the conversation that got brought up earlier with the 3-4-3. This was, you know, El Paso has been running a 3-man back line. And I think of the three of the 4 USL teams they've played so far kind of typically run a 3-man back line. If I'm just kind of remembering off the top of my head, there's a lot of 3-man back line, and a lot of that comes down to the fact that Europe, you started seeing a lot more of it. And as all things go, tactics kind of work its way down. Like it is trickle tactical economics. Basically, it starts up at the top and it slowly works its way around and works its way out. And a lot of times, what you have is a probably a fullback who has lost a step, and they get to go play in the back line, and they have someone who is a really good ball-carrying center back who can carry the ball up and down, who maybe is a midfielder, kind of like what we were seeing out of Pittsburgh with Danny Griffin. Like, that's what they wanted Danny Griffin to be, was this ball-carrying center back. It's not quite working, but that's what they wanted out of him. That's what Bob Lilly wanted. Or you could get, you know, look at your Birmingham side, or I think even Lexington, if they're playing them, like Corrales. Like, that is a fullback who has kind of maybe lost a little bit of a step, but still good with the ball at their feet, can get up and down the pitch. And it allows your wing talent, which there is a lot of it in the USL, and I think that's a big part of it. There's a lot of wing talent in the USL. You let your wings do their work. You let them eat a little bit. It just ends up being a very free-flowing system, typically. And also, when teams get their goal or two, it allows them very easily just to park the bus and don't allow anything.
I think the interesting thing is that if you like look team by team, Birmingham and North Carolina are the only two teams that have made the switch this year. But that's made the difference to get you over the 50% mark. Half of the league essentially right now is using a back three. That feels like a pretty significant marker at this point, right? And it's the reasons you stated. It gives you that extra set of feet when you're building out to have that possessive control. We're seeing more and more USL teams every year avoid the long ball, really try to kind of play with possession in mind. At the same time, if you want to get aggressive with it, those outside backs can push up, really compress the pitch, support a higher press. So there's benefits every way to kind of modernize the style of football you're seeing in the USL. I think it's important. And I think that it shows that there's a real sophistication to the coaching in this division. Like, I mean, look at Cano Smith, who's coming in and using a really progressive 3-4-1-2 shape with Rhode Island, pressing high, controlling the game with that model. He's not going to choose a shape that's outmoded. And I mean, that's the reason why you're seeing it across the board.
Connor Davis kind of puts this in the chat. Lucid switched to a three back. It scares me. Lucid's kind of always been a three back. They may announce in the past, they may have announced it as a four back, but Tyler Gibson was a third center back when they were in possession. Like, he dropped in so deep. While
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, like, whenever you had, like, Oscar and you had Dia really bombing up the wings, like, I mean, Gibson was sitting so far deep. You were essentially running a three-man back line even when they weren't. Now, when they went to a proper three-man back, like, Gibson was getting up. Like, he was getting up there, and he was very – he was wonderful with the ball at his feet. But whenever they were running that four-man back, he was just dropping in constantly.
Well, that's where formations are kind of a crapshoot. Like, Louisville was going to be a back three team when they possessed, no matter what, even if they defended with four defenders and then that holding midfielder. So, like, at a certain point, it is academic. But I think the fact that you're just seeing more teams kind of move players around in that way, just a further good sign.
What Popes puts into the chat, or what Birmingham is doing with Enzo. I don't know what Birmingham's doing with Enzo. He's a CDM center back striker. Everything you want a man to be.
It's a normal combo.
Let's go ahead and move on just a little bit real fast. I would like to get to Orange County versus Miami. John, start fathoming. They're getting results.
Yeah, you know it's good when I get the quote tweet from Miami FC to tell me to start fathoming. I do think, like, we've praised Nocerino a lot in the early stages of the season because he's got this team so well drilled. It's a more sophisticated style of soccer than I initially gave them credit for. Like, in that first game, he came out and wanted to just play over the top of Colorado Springs, and that made sense for that game. Against Orange County, Miami barely played the long balls. They weren't route one. They really wanted to goad that Orange County press up. And when the moment struck, they were going to hit into Alan Gavilanes because he is unreal in transition. But that wasn't the only way that they could create chances or break through. Then you get into the defensive block. They've got that, I'm calling it a 4-4-1-1. Call it what you want. It's really compact. It's really hard to break down. Orange County kind of just living off of set pieces in a lot of ways at this point in the year, but you'll take it. Very cool for Ashton Miles to get the goal in that game. I've talked to Nicholas about this, in fact, and he highlighted in his young player spotlight, Miles is a guy who's homegrown, came up in the OC system, as opposed to the Oshendinas, the Kobe Henrys, who kind of developed elsewhere and came in to Orange County SC like it was a finishing school. Miles is their guy, and to see him be one of the best central defenders in the league so far and then get the goal, amazing stuff. So I think a lot of positives on both sides. Want some more spark from Orange County just to throw that out there, but they have the luxury of being able to ease in and know that, hey, you can always just pull off like an 8-game winning streak in the summer.
I mean, to kind of point out what you're talking about here, you know, you talk about Route 1 versus Colorado Springs. They completed, or they attempted just over like 300 passes, and it felt like most of those were with their own center backs before they just tried to go long and, you know, kind of say boost down there somewhere. And, you know, against Sacramento, weirdly enough, it was a little bit more free flowing. Yes. Sacramento dominated the ball, but like, it felt like Miami, not comfortable, but they were there. To go from having just over 300 passes versus Colorado Springs to having over 400 versus Orange County, that shows that they, like you said, they're knocking around a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Unlike, and I say this because it works really well for Hartford. It works really, really well for Hartford. One thing that I noticed in watching Hartford early season is it's 1-2 touch, go out wide to your wings because you have Mitchell Galena and Deshaun Beckford, and you can do that. But it's one touch, two touch, you know, one pass, two pass, go long. It's not that way for Miami. They seem like they can switch it up just a little bit, which I was very excited to see.
And you invoked Andrew Booth. Shout out to his defensive solidity in the middle of the park for them. He's a player I kind of think of as a number 10. Like, that was at least the rap on him coming up from Greenville. What he's done box to box this season, like the goal in the opener, sure, but solidifying in the middle of the pitch, unreal. And it's cool to see, right? Like, it's the two Greenville guys that are the real standouts for Miami right now.
I mean, it's always fun to see. And this is just another case of, and the USL Championship's gotten a lot better at this. So we're not screaming into the void as much as we were, but League One's legit. Like, I think fans need to stop just being like League One, lower league. Like, the gap's not that far. Like, Booth was really good in Greenville, but he wasn't a superstar in that league, and he is more than contributing at the championship level. I think that should tell you where both leagues are right now.
Well, if you think about this Miami side, Samuel Biak was an FC Tucson guy. Nico Cardona was with Chattanooga, right? Dalton Knutson was Tormenta. Gavilanes and Booth, we talked about. On the bench, they had Michael Vang, who was in there. Gabriel Freitas was a Tormenta guy, I want to say.
Another Tormenta guy, yeah.
Like, that's more than half a dozen players from Miami were born and bred in League One. That's amazing for this league.
Not to mention, like last year, Jake McGuire was another League One guy. There was another League One guy that went down there. That was, I think, once again, Tormenta. Like, Miami tapped into that pipeline a little bit harder than everybody else, and I think they're finally starting to see a little bit of the fruit of the labor for it. Something I said last year earlier this offseason when we saw Miami kind of going to what they're doing right now, they paid a lot of money to get average results. They're paying not a lot of money right now to, if they're going to get the same results out of a lot less money, that's a win for ownership. If they're going to pay a lot less money for better results, I think, is it Ricardo Sanchez?
Yeah, Ricardo Silva.
Silva, thank you. Mr. Silva, hey man, flashy name does not always equal good. Welcome to the sports. Like, you know, trusting your coaches to find the deep cuts it's working out for them early doors.
Every time I think about the fact that they paid $750,000 for Richie Ryan, it just makes less sense, and I cherish it always.
I think it's funnier that it was Richie Ryan.
Richie Ryan, at the time, like, elite defensive midfielder in the NASL, but, like, it's Richie Ryan for a fee that you would never see a USL team pay today.
If
a
you,
decade later, almost.
I can tell you, I can almost guarantee you this. If you were, if your team gets $750,000 for a player, that number gets leaked. It's not the mysterious, like, could be up to six, like, figures. Like, your team is announcing that.
Right. Like, that's a point of pride if you're getting that money. Yeah.
Just incredible. Let's go ahead. I want to talk about League One just a little bit. We'll talk about Phoenix and Oakland in a second, but
are we skipping about Detroit Loudoun? Are you just like waiting?
No, I want to get into that. I want to talk about Richmond Tormenta though.
Yeah.
That was, if you did, people just need to go back and watch that match. Unreal. Just how good of a match that was. And yes, my Johnny Dean is playing goalkeeper for Tormenta. The tweets will continue. but seriously though, Ford Parker, if you have not been seeing what Ford Parker is doing in League One with Tormenta right now, it is unbelievable, because Richmond probably should be walking away either with a draw or a win if it wasn't for what Ford Parker did in that match.
I mean, Tormenta came out with the style where they really want to press you. Often that meant moving Tevio de Almeida from the pivot higher upfield in the press. So you're leaving Connor Doyle alone as the single holding midfielder. I love Connor Doyle. He scores bangers for fun. Probably not the guy you want as the lone defensive presence protecting your back line. But hey, when Ford Parker is standing on his head like he did, just insane. Like, that's something that this team's going to be able to rely on down the stretch. And you do have to give credit to Richmond playing the kids, by the way. Nick yes. Simmons, the 17-year-old Jamaican. Was it Griffin Garnett in the midfield? Another yes. teenager from the academy. Amazing stuff. We don't talk enough about how fun to watch Neil Vignoles is. One of the most skillful players in League One for years on end. I went back and did the replay of this game, catching up, since the championship tends to kind of eat up my Saturdays. That game was worth the price of admission. Just skill on both sides. I thought the late substitution with Arthur Basawa coming on, I think making his debut for the Kickers, he was immediately impactful at the number nine spot. The holdup play, the physicality, nearly got ahead of goal. Really well played on both sides. The kind of game that makes you feel good about the hopes for both of these teams going forward.
For sure. I always end up watching Richmond, and I say always. Now I'm getting into, like, it wasn't fair with what happened in Detroit, because Adrian Bilhart could have been a real superstar of the championship.
I was noting him in the Open Cup game, where it seems like his movement was just next level. Like, he's somebody who's thinking at a level that's above the USL championship. He's got the skill to pay that off. Definitely, it was weird for him in what was kind of a transition year, ultimately, in Detroit, where they couldn't settle in a system. Trevor James ended up being out the door. Cool to see him land back in Richmond, where he's going to be a difference maker.
Let's talk about Detroit. Detroit walks away with a 2-1 win over the People's Champ. And, I mean, Jop with a banger. Like, banger of all bangers. And then Faro, like, here's one thing I will say about this with Faro. And this is something that, hashtag ad, if you listen to the Jake McGuire for the Glove of the Game, something that he talked about a lot was refusing to pass on pressure to his defenders. Like, there was several times I asked him, I was like, you had a defender open, why did you kick it long? And he said, all I'm doing is passing on defenders. It's like, he basically said it's becoming crisis averted. you're just hoping somebody else makes the mistake. It felt like they kind of did that with Pharrell. Like, I don't think he should have that ball at his feet played to him there. He, like, there's nowhere for him to go. He couldn't go back.
Yeah.
Someone there. He couldn't kick it long for obvious reasons of what happened. Maxi Rodriguez eventually gets a deflection into a tap in. That was just a moment where Pharrell gets the – he gets the – when playing it out of the back goes wrong,
yeah,
you know, highlight against him. But I don't really think that's him. Like, there's nothing he could have done.
No, I think in a lot of ways it's systematic. Like, Loudon, even in game one against the San Antonio press that was a lot harsher than Detroit's was on balance, like, Loudon did not want to play a long ball in that game at all. And you saw that again, where just the tendency to pass at the back and try to play yourself out of trouble ultimately probably cost them 2 points out of, or rather 3 points out of this one. Like, you hate to see it, but you like the fact that Ryan Martin is going to stick to his guns and try to be consistent with how he wants that team to play. So credit in that sense, but definitely can't blame Pharrell too much for the concession.
Elvis Amo, I think I said this last week, maybe, or I said it somewhere. Elvis Amo feels like what they missed from Hopeno. Like, there's an excitingness to him. There's also a grittiness that comes into his game that it just seems like, and like Nicholas Murray is saying, is like, see where he was pre-Hartford. It's really interesting to see just kind of what he did, just a knack for being in the right place at the right time. I was kind of impressed with what he was doing defensively too. Like, he was putting in some work, you know, trying to win balls back. It felt like this is already a team that's already playing as a team with Detroit.
I think on both sides, just watching this game, seeing the style, the way that they pass, the way that they move off the ball, this felt like one of the most technical games of USL soccer that I've maybe ever seen, which is a high compliment.
It's up there.
And when you're thinking about this, and no offense to the clubs, but it's Loudon United and Detroit City, right? Like, they've come out playing incredibly good soccer. And in that second half for Detroit especially, they sharpened their movement in a way where they just couldn't be stopped. And Amo was such a huge part of it, the way that he was dragging defenders out of shape, the way that whenever there was a turnover, he was committing in the counter press. I think he's an interesting guy just because he can contribute defensively, but you've got to feed him an attack or he's going to be a little bit disinterested. And that's how a lot of strikers are. So seeing him engaged like this right from the get-go is huge. Just, I mean, I'm loving everything about Detroit right now. And they've not even needed Steinwasher to, like, be Nate Steinwasher to get there already. So when push comes to shove and they're playing against the Charlestons and the Louisvilles, they have that extra level where, listen, you've got probably maybe the best goalie in the league right now with Nate Steinwasher, on top of the fact that they've got a banging 10 outfield players in front of him, really high on Detroit.
I want to kind of go to Loudon just for a second. Yeah. I think a lot of people are going to look at underlying numbers and be like, they're not creating a lot. They're not doing this. They're not doing that. Their hot start's not sustainable. They're like, it's just like last year, Loudon. Despite their underlying numbers, when I say underlying numbers, typically you're looking at your XGs, your expected goals, your expected assist, you know, just general like press, you know, presses per defensive action or, you know, that kind of stuff, right? You're looking at that kind of stuff and saying, is this sustainable? Compared to last year, despite the underlying numbers not looking amazing for the output they're getting, this looks sustainable. This looks like this can be repeated. And like you mentioned with Zach Martin, he's going to sustain what he's doing because he's not changing it. He doesn't care. He is going to keep doing what he's doing. And if anything, I think there's something to that in the fact that if it's not working, he'll find a player that makes the system work.
Well, it's been interesting to see the way that like players like Wesley Leggett, who were nothing more than a super sub last year, have become key contributors. to the point that you didn't put Cristiano Francois right back in the lineup when he's back from red card or suspension. That's a vote of confidence, but it shows the fact that there's depth here. And we've talked about it ad nauseum, but the difference between this Loudon team and the one that hasn't been able to sustain is the fact that you've got McCabe, you've got Skundrich, Erlinson and Hughes have been unreal at center back. There's a spine and a sense of, I don't know, control. Like, these are error-free players in a lot of ways, and you've never seen that from Loudon United before. So it makes you feel good going forward for Ryan Martin and co.
I want to quickly, I mean, super quickly, hit Loose City versus Pitt. Yikes. Out of Pitt. I mean, look, all credit to Loose City. They look every bit of being the juggernaut that they are. They look like they are fully back-back. But also, Jesus Christ, Pitt. Also, listen, I want to just go ahead. I want to beat the allegations. Kizza is the guy who scored the 3 goals versus Birmingham in the playoff game, like, you know, 2 years ago. So before it comes off as salty Birmingham fan, yes, but also no. With how things have started for Pittsburgh, I don't think Kizza can taunt the Louisville faithful after scoring their first goal of the season.
I will say that Kizza was maybe Pittsburgh's most engaged player, and I'm choosing my words carefully because I don't want to maybe say good. But like, I think if you're Pittsburgh right now and anyone is taunting any fans, that's a bold choice. Like, you want to have the confidence, but you got to back it up, and they are not backing it up.
To what Connor Davis said, Bobbly had a 25-minute conversation with the team on the pitch. That's the shortest Bob Lilly conversation of all time.
Yeah, that's a likely place for Bob Lilly to be.
At times, Louisville looked like they were playing with their food, especially the last goal. And you wrote about this, hashtag ad. But it looked like they were playing with their food.
Yeah, well, I mean, well, for Pittsburgh, there was a 20-25-minute stretch coming out of halftime where they really started to press. They got their teeth into the game a little bit. It felt competitive. And then Louisville realized, wait, our counterpress is amazing. Ray Serrano is tearing it up in the middle of the park. They can't beat our center backs. We can just grab this game by the neck and really just take it to them. It was encouraging to see this team find the goals. There was maybe a lack of chemistry up front between Serrano and Harris and Perez in that El Paso game. They could have got a couple more for me against the Locomotive. And by the time they were in the second 45 against Pittsburgh, they were clicking in a pretty meaningful way. It's hard for me to see a team that's clearly better than Loose City right now. Like, they feel like they've got the players, they've got the system. This is the year that they're really going to reestablish the fact that we're Loose City, we're going to the conference final, and we're going to deserve it.
Quickly, let's go over to Oakland Phoenix, where Phoenix finally looked like kind of last year's title run Phoenix, where you mentioned Panos earlier, where he looked unbelievable. And Paul Blanchett is in typical Paul Blanchett mode, where he's just standing on his head and just stopping everything. You know, I feel, how many times last year did we say, oh, Oakland lost 1-0, Paul Blanchett had like 12 saves. Like,
he's the wall. Yeah.
Like, it's another game like that. Phoenix, I'll be honest. I know the questions we said earlier was where the goal is going to come from. I also trust that this team is going to create enough chances that goals will come, and they finally did. Oakland, a team that you said early on, you know, you mentioned the chameleon. They can kind of just form into anything. They barely created anything, and the only thing they created, none of them were on target. Like, are you, like, worried about Oakland at all, or is it just it was just a one-off thing?
So Oakland last week got hit with some sort of illness, some sort of flu bug where half the lineup was out. This week, they're missing Tamakas and Neville Hackshaw with international duty. You have to put a Cam Riley, Daniel Gomez pivot is just not what you want to see if you're trying to move the ball at all. And the fact that they couldn't break Phoenix's press to save their life was kind of game over from the get-go in this one. And credit to Phoenix, who took full advantage. I think for Rising, the interesting thing offensively was the offense was more than just Panos and Rito on the right. Like, Armanakis was able to dish the ball out to Juan Azakar from that left wing back spot. Then Armanakis had the freedom to make those runs like you saw in the game-winning goal. If he can go and get into the box when Derek Formella just isn't doing that or Remy Cabral doesn't quite have the chemistry, that's going to give Rising that secondary scoring that they need to pay off the abundance of chances that they're creating. I think that for Phoenix, like that Monterrey game where they really laid an egg was probably an aberration. This feels closer to the level for them. And it should have Rising fans feeling pretty good because I thought they looked immense.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, this is kind of what we saw in their first game versus Birmingham where they were creating chances like crazy. It was just where the goal's going to come from. And, you know, everything just felt like it was coming from a wide area. I mean, yeah, you mentioned Formella, winger playing up top because he's a winger who's playing up top. It is hard. I mean, Juan Azakar, the fact that we're not saying loney Juan Azakar is kind of weird to me. I feel like that's that one's just weird, but you know, I mean, he's great. I love watching Juan. He is so much fun when he's on, when he is himself. There's no one else like him in the league, and he's just so much fun.
I mean, the fact that they've got Azakar and Rito back together after what they did in Oakland, like, that's going to be a weapon. Everybody knows that those two are an offense in and of themselves. So really fun to see Azakar healthy and playing after whatever happened in San Antonio.
Nicholas Murray kind of put in there right now, Matt Van Oakle is going to be playing the Paul Blanchet role this season. 19 shots on target allowed by Legion, have only conceded the one goal.
Yes.
Just
that's insane.
Gross. Real fast, we might touch that one. I don't know. Lexington won Knox.
Yes.
You and I were not out on Lexington, but we did not have them as the consensus one seed when we did our USL League One show. And this is not us saying that Lexington's a bad team by any stretch, but I feel like the early cracks that we highlight on the show are very apparent right now.
I wrote a little bit about them last week in terms of the fact that they just aren't getting any offense from their right side right now. Like, Tate Robertson has not been able to get the ball. They've not got Christian Young generating anything from the right back spot. Credit to Jorge Corrales, who really has been the one initiator. Simply, Lexington doesn't have the guns they need to distribute from the back, and it's hurting them. Atis Diouf isn't getting touches. He's got 3 shots all season. The Vermont Green game was what it was, but in the league, they look pallid. They look very, almost disinterested in the press. They're very much sitting back and kind of daring opponents to come at them. They have the depth and the skill to go at teams and dictate the terms of a match, and they simply aren't doing that right now. Now, one Knox is probably a big reason why that happened over the weekend. They're a team that came out way better than I expected. Angelo Kelly-Rosales has been a revelation in the forward line. Like, he's playing this kind of right wing number 8 fluid position, popping up between the lines, facilitating play. I think the interaction between their wingers and their wingbacks has been tremendous so far. Like, Knoxville is doing everything right, but it's been frustrating to see Lexington kind of lay an egg to date.
It's not fully fair to talk on Darren Powell because, I mean, he has been when his time in the championship kind of was what it was. It was consistent, but it wasn't always good enough. You know, Inter Miami 2, whatever they end up calling them, that it's a 2 team, right? And then he goes over to England. He's with Crystal Palace. It's with a U21 team. But there were times where we were making these same comments about his teams, though. Borderline disinterested. Like, didn't feel like they were fully clicking on things that they should be clicking on. I'm not saying that Powell is the problem. Because, I mean, our boots on the ground, when you talk to Tyler Crane from Crane Kicks Lex, he is all the way in. He could not be more in on Darren Powell. He's believing in the message that's being taught, which makes me think that it's there. But there is a bit of a pattern.
He's somebody who we've talked a lot about progressive modern soccer on this episode. I don't think Powell is necessarily that guy. I think he's more likely to have you sit back, kind of prefer the long balls, prefer not to sell out in the press. When you're playing a team like Wadnox, who's a little bit more up to it, it can bite you. So curious to see what adjustments come for Lexington, who on paper ought to be one of the top teams in this division.
And we mentioned Wadnox in our League One, in our League One show about how their offseason wasn't sexy, but I think we both kind of said there's has to be a reason why they didn't really change anything. They just believed from within, and early on, McKeever is proving us right and wrong and saying, yeah, the answer was already right here. Why would we need to spend more money when we spent it last season? It's already here.
Yeah, I mean, they're starting 8 or 9 players who are returners from a team that was pretty mediocre, and the results have been night and day better. The additions have made a difference. Like, Sievert Hoagly has been a real steadier in the central midfield, which, hand up, I called him maybe the worst defender in the USL Championship when we did our season preview. So moving him into the midfield, inspired. Like, I think McKeever knew what he was doing, and clearly it's paying off so far.
Just so I can give love to Hartford, because Hartford deserves a ton of love right now. They win 1-0 over Birmingham Legion. The one thing I put on Twitter, I put it in our Discord. Check out our Discord. They had an XCG, an expected completed goals, which basically means if it's on target, it's more like that's kind of what you're looking at. For example, they say an XG of a penalty kick is 0.76. But if it's on frame, it has an 86% chance of going in. So basically, if it's on target, it has a better chance of going in. They calculate it that way. Basically, if the goalkeeper wasn't there, would the goal have gone in? You know, that's kind of what they're calculating. Their XCG on shots that were put on target, they had a 5.13. They were expected to score 5 goals in that game. And put it down to bad finishing, Matt Van Okel standing on his head, whatever. Who cares that they just got one? It looked like a horrible, rainy, cold night in Hartford. That was an unreal offensive performance. Just an unreal offensive performance from Hartford.
When you think about the fact that Romario Williams was gone with the Jamaica national team and they're starting like teenager Mamadou Dieng, like, that makes the performance that much more impressive to see. I mean, what you got out of Beckford and Galena on the wings was simply ridiculous. Like, I actually thought Birmingham came with a fairly considerate approach to how they wanted to defend that team. And you can point to errors for sure from the Legion. But what Hartford was doing on the wings, you could have put them against Man City and they would have got some results. Like, those players are cooking at a level that is utterly ridiculous right now. Hartford is going to be so dangerous.
Yeah, I think one thing that I got to mention here is Maji Marana, who was the right wing back for Birmingham Legion. I can't think of a much worse time to get your first professional appearance than having to go against Michi Galena.
That's be messed up.
That's messed up.
And we got to give credit to the team of the week player from Hartford here, and Anderson Asiadu, who clearly came out just passionate. He was dominating the central midfield. You can talk on that, but I was happy to see him really have a banger of a game.
the scoop assist was gross.
Disgusting.
It was unbelievably good. Anderson almost had a real nice goal. Matt Van Okel denied him as well. I mean, Anderson was distributing the ball well, just defensively, just great, connecting the play so well. It sucks to be on this side of it, but also it's so nice to just see him playing again. I think a lot of the USL forgot just how good Anderson Asaidu is, and he showed it. And I'm just saying, maybe it was Legion not letting him fully spread the wings. He didn't have that kind of assist in his locker last year, and if that's what Brendan Burke is going to be getting out of him this year,
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of the beauty of putting two kind of number six, number eight players next to each other, is that they've got that give and take, and Asiedu clearly feels pretty liberated to, like you said, spread his wings and kind of be creative, which, hey, if he's got it in his bag, let him do it.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, it was just a fun match. I don't want to – this is not to me being too salty or anything like that. Like, I do want to say that outright. It's kind of hard for me to tell what went fully wrong on the Birmingham side, mm-hmm. because a lot of the things that I was looking for, the cameras just weren't picking it up. Like, you know, like, they didn't have as many camera angles as you would want. So, like, if I – you know, sometimes they show alternate views of certain things, and they just didn't have that. So it's hard for me to really get into the weeds of what Birmingham was doing wrong. But boy, were they showing what Hartford were doing right. Just unbelievable.
That's my big takeaway from this game for sure.
Let's go ahead and predict some matches. Why don't we? Just fun stuff. What are you doing, dummy?
Oh, God. You got a nice, nice audible meow there.
He gets the zoomies at about 9 p.m. and 5:30 in the morning. Every other time, he is just asleep and having a blast. Like, just sleeping.
Cat for you.
Yeah. He's as sweet as can be. But God bless him. Let's go ahead and get into these predictions, why don't we? Let's start off with Phoenix versus New Mexico. Phoenix, you know, gets their finishing boots on in New Mexico. Well, they got shellacked. Can they respond?
Yeah, I mean, a nice Southwestern rivalry game here. New Mexico is still a team that I believe in, even though clearly I thought that Charleston kind of had their number. The question for me is Phoenix able to sell out and shut down Micheletto and Bailey as those deep-lying creators without kind of sacrificing their shape and throwing off their own offense? Ultimately, I lean yes, and I think Phoenix does win this game. I think it's going to be a real litmus test for both of these teams, though.
I agree. I think we're going to learn a lot about these teams, even if it ends in a draw. I think that we are going to learn a lot about both clubs. I'm taking New Mexico, and it's not really just New Mexico bounce back and Phoenix falls back down to earth. I don't think that at all. I just think that what New Mexico brings is going to challenge Phoenix a little bit more, and even Phoenix struggled with what they were getting out of Oakland. Kind of back at New Mexico in that. Charlotte versus Spokane. Spokane has already been kind of talked about in our Discord chat of like, hey, they are for real. Like, a lot of people are like, yo, they are scarier than we think they'll be. Charlotte not really fitting the bill of League One runner-up from last year. Where are you feeling?
Charlotte a bit odd. They've only played once, and it was against a Knox team that might be a weapon. I've only seen Spokane really play a full game against Ballard in the Open Cup, and Ballard kind of took it to them. I know I need to hit the tape a little bit more with Spokane, but I think this is the game where Charlotte kind of establishes the fact that, listen, we're here. We were in the final last season. We've got most of that team back. We're going to get a win in this game and set the tone.
For me, I'm taking Spokane because they just haven't played, or Charlotte hasn't played as much, weirdly. I feel like Spokane's more into the flow of the season at this point. Dolling, he's been okay for me. It kind of is what it is with him. Louise Hill is ridiculous. just absolutely ridiculous. And Lewis and Denton have been an incredible, just, you know, holding midfield pairing that if Charlotte is not quite up to the true match fitness quite yet, those two are going to be a handful. I kind of lean Spokane for that win. Next up,
I will say real quick that I'm lifelong Andre Lewis fan club, and I love to see the King getting his starts.
Yes. Let's go ahead and go to the All Green Derby. There's a name. It's the Geo Tyler Derby. Yeah. It's Lex Luthor versus the best hair in the game. Lexington sputtering and Greenville looks solid. I'm really happy with what Greenville's doing early on.
Greenville looked stifling against Forward Madison. Like, defensively, they're as good as they're ever going to be. I think this is maybe the game where we're going to, like, we got Zion Scarlett having the breakout in week one. I think either him, Ben Zukowski, Mohamed Seye, one of those young forwards is going to have himself a night. I don't trust Powell to make the right changes quite yet. Like, I think that this team needs to dig themselves a little bit more of a hole before they make the corrections. So I'm going Triumph outright.
Me too. You know, the one or the 0-0 draw against Ford Madison, you know, you can say, well, they didn't really create, Greenville didn't really create a whole lot. Their XG is inflated by a missed penalty. They forced Ford Madison to not do anything. Mm-hmm. And versus a Lexington team who has not done anything in terms of creating chances except for their, you know, whatever they did in the Open Cup, that was just pure vibes. I think that this Greenville defense alone is going to lock down Lexington. I'm taking Greenville. Were they my lock? They were not my lock. Came close though. Tampa Bay versus Rhode Island. Tampa Bay, hey, like, they look like they can be dangerous. And we talked about it last week. Forrest Lasso looks like he's Forrest Lasso again, going against Rhode Island, who gets a 2-2 draw against Monterey. But this is not your preseason Monterey. Monterey looks like they are for real.
Tampa Bay, Rhode Island.
What'd I say?
You started talking about Monterey. Oh, never mind. I got the drift. I zoned.
Small recap to do the preview.
Getting confused because we got some maybe have Monterey coming up in these predictions. So got my zone switched. But in any event, Tampa Bay against North Carolina, a team that presses in a 3-4-3 that is not dissimilar from Rhode Island's. They held the Rowdies to 0.2 expected goals last week. Tampa Bay just could not break them down. Granted, they did get a goal from, like, the one sequence where they were able to get Lewis Hilton dictating play from the middle. We're going to need to see more of that. Rhode Island, the big question mark is Koke Vegas's health after the injury at the end of the game on Sunday night. Even without him, I think that they're really well set up to go and win this game. I think they're motivated to finally get that first win on the books. I'm going to Rhode Island pretty confidently.
Don't forget what Jackson Lee is, by the way. I mean, Jackson Lee was a first-round pick goalkeeper. MLS teams don't take goalkeepers in the first round. Like, he's real.
And when they do, they go and sign Hugo Lloris and then release the guy.
Yeah. I mean, if it's me, I mean, you know who I'm taking, and it's not Hugo Lloris, but whatever. but, I mean, Forrest Lasso, I mean, we talked about it last week. Forrest Lasso looked like Forrest Lasso again. Like, Tampa Bay looked okay, and they looked good defensively for me. But, man, Rhode Island just presents such a different tactical approach than you're going to see in a lot of the league. Like, you can do as much film study as you want. They are just bizarre to watch in the best way possible. I have to pull this one up. I went with Tampa Bay, and it's for no other reason than Tampa Bay is at home. It just feels like they can't. Al Lang just feels like one of those places that they just don't lose.
No, but that's fair.
You mentioned it. We got there. San Antonio versus Monterey Bay. San Antonio, hey, they're doing their thing, you know, mentality. They're all about the mentality, as we all know. Colorado Springs, they beat them 2-0. They kind of continue from their come from behind Tampa Bay game. Meanwhile, like I mentioned, this is not your preseason Monterey. Monterey looks really freaking good. This is going to be a real interesting one to see how these two bite it out.
I'm so excited for this matchup. I think Monterey Bay, the way that they're able to have their midfielders control the game, that Baca, Fair, Adrian Rebolar trio, that's going to do a lot to beat the new look San Antonio. You're going to need a good performance from that back line. You had the gaffe, right, where Guzman and Kai Green just couldn't quite handle Abritikwa twice over, and it made the difference to ultimately lead to a draw. I think I trust San Antonio to really try to make a statement here. So that's not to disparage Monterey Bay, who I'm 100% in on, but I have San Antonio getting this win.
If you look at our predictions that we put in our Discord, I put Monterey with a question mark. I'm like not really sure, because I trust in what San Antonio's doing. There is something to be said about long-term success. It's the same reason we just kind of blindly trust Lou City good. Like, it's the same reason why we blindly trust Bob Lilly good, and why the beginnings of the season for Pittsburgh are so shocking for us, right? Until Marcina and co. prove to me that they're bad, it's hard for me not to trust, right? But God, Monterey Bay looked so good. I'm taking Monterey Bay because I feel like what they're doing is sustainable. I feel like it can be repeated, and I'm really intrigued to see what it is. This is my personal game of the week.
I think I'm probably with you on that. Yeah.
Yeah, this is a good one.
This and Knoxville Tormenta, I'm excited for.
Knoxville Tormenta, I'm excited to see if Tormenta can really continue, especially with Colley gone. I know he was gone before, but also, or will he be back?
I don't know.
He's on international. If he's back, he's going to get limited play time. But, you know, that's going to be an interesting one. That one's fun too.
Can I just shout out Philip, or he goes by Ajmir apparently, Ajmir Spengler, who is ridiculously good on the wing for Tormenta. He got a really nice goal or maybe an assist against Charleston in that preseason friendly right before the year started. Mm-hmm. He got an assist in their latest game. He's on fire so far.
Yeah, he's unbelievable. Another just must watch. Shadow Wolf, we've already done the Phoenix, New Mexico. Just go back just a little bit. It will be in there. Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff going on right now. So much good stuff around the league. Lots of stuff we talked about. Heavy hitter of an episode. Final thoughts for the night, unless you have another USL?
No, I got nothing more USL-wise. Final thoughts. Been a busy stretch for me. Just been trying to chill, keeping up with Shogun. Started back into the revival of the old X-Men animated series on Disney+. They brought that back from the grave, and I don't know if it's like good necessarily, but it's like comfort food. So enjoying that.
Yeah, it's kind of like I know sometimes we just kind of put on like reruns of Friends and stuff like that. Right. I don't actually watch it. It's just background sound because it's there, and I just kind of it's there for me.
Yeah, I mean, this is like. Like, I've read the comics, I watched the old series, like, just seeing this stuff. Like, I know where it's going already, so it's just, like, I zone out, and I'm watching, but not really.
Fair. Yeah. No, I need to watch Shogun. I always tell myself I need to watch Shogun, and I still haven't watched it, but I need to watch it. But also need to watch both Dune and Dune 2, because I feel really left out.
You kind of miss the cycle on Dune 2. So if you just hold strong for a little bit more, you're going to be good.
See, I kind of did the same thing with Ted Lasso. I still haven't seen it, and I feel like the wave is gone, so I've forgotten that I haven't watched it, and then I'm just like, need to watch
Yeah,
it.
like the statute of limitations is passed. Like you don't have to do it anymore.
Yeah, true. Let's see, my interesting. Oh, tomorrow at I don't have to teach band or Spanish because I have been voluntold to play it in a volleyball game.
This is the most school, like you're teaching kids thing
Yeah,
ever.
they were like, they walked up to me and they were like, "Hey, wear red tomorrow." And I was like, "Is it Red Ribbon Week? Like,
Yes.
what's going on?" They're like, "No, you're playing the senior boys in a volleyball game." And I'm like, "Why am I doing that?" And they're like, "Because we raised money for the library." And I'm like, "We did what?"
Well, you've got the height. You're gonna be spiking it in these kids' faces.
Some of those kids can dunk. I'm screwed.
That's a good point. Yeah, senior in high school, like you've lost the athletic edge at that point.
Like they're in their athletic prime, and I'm just not.
Arguably, I've never had an athletic prime.
Oh man. Oh, I love. Okay, so Nicholas Murray's watching. See, I understand the Ben Clemens comment, but I just haven't watched it. New Zealand versus England, cricket. I love cricket. I watch so much cricket in my free time. I'm watching baseball and cricket. If someone's filming it, I might try to get a video and see. Like, if I fall on my face, there will be a video of it somewhere. So that'll be posted eventually.
Yeah, on some high schoolers' TikTok.
I've already been there. Yeah. Oh, speaking of tomorrow, soccer down here, 10 a.m. It's we'll be on there and talking about ATL stuff. So
Yeah,
yeah.
never been a better time to tune in to an Atlanta-centric show, people.
To be fair, they do a really good job of not just being so
Oh, they're
Atlanta-centric.
great. They're
Like,
great, but
they're
still.
great, yeah. But yeah, that's about it. Don't forget, people. Send good vibes to Alan and Ryan. Check out what Phil just posted on Twitter. With Malloy and stuff like that. Just he saw the vision as Charleston pointed out. And remember, people, for one last time tonight, we can be bought. We can be bought. The USL show at gmail.com. Reach out. Thank you all so much. And here for the first time and final time tonight, here's Alan's voice.
Thank you for watching another episode of the USL Show.
The USL Show is now proudly part of the Protagonist Podcast family. Please go to protagonistsoccer.com to check out more work. Thanks for stopping by, and we'll see everyone again next time.